going to start this episode with a story. Tonight was really rough. Getting home from work, or getting to my daughter's school from work at peak rush hour, something crazy was happening. My husband was working late, and I rushed to her school thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be the last mom to pick her up. Or the last parent to pick her up. In my head, it was mom. And I was second to last. We get home, and I thought I had texted our nanny saying, hey, kids, we'll just have mac and cheese tonight. Let's keep it easy. But by the time we got home, and there was another different, lovely, equally tasty meal on the table, which, God bless our nanny, I don't know genuinely how I would function in the life I have today without her. It was just a different meal. And that's when it all started. So my four-year-old daughter, Ajna, just didn't want that food. So she didn't eat it. I tried to get her to eat a few bites. She said she was too tired to eat on her own. I tried to feed her a few bites, so forth and so on. Somehow the situation escalated to the point where she was so distraught about something or the other, even though I caved and gave her something else, which is for many not best practice because you want to get your kid to eat the food that they're given. And I genuinely am not totally sure what prompted the meltdown, but there was such a bad meltdown. I had just prepped my dinner because I was really hungry and didn't get in the house and through the house fast enough to like eat with them. And she is coming down the stairs very, very slowly because I had gone down, the plate was hot in my hand of my own dinner. And I was like, okay, I'll still sit downstairs with you. That she had an accident. So I hope this doesn't embarrass her one day, but somehow we are having a teeny tiny potty training regression with a girl who's been potty trained for 2 years. Who knows? And I just had no patience, I guess, at that point in the evening. And I think my energy was a little irritated and probably a bit standoffish, because what I've realized I do when I'm upset or frustrated or tired is just become kind of cold. And she picked up on that, and it just didn't really get better from there. And being the emotional child she is, her mother's daughter after all, she said to me that it really hurt her when I got mad at her for having her accident. And said that, you know when you have to go to the bathroom, why didn't you just come down the stairs versus, you know, coming so slowly, dragging your feet? And she said, Mommy, I had told you I'm so tired. I was so tired I couldn't come down the stairs by myself. And then you didn't come and help me, and you didn't come and get me, and I accidentally had an accident, and now you're mad. And I just felt like shit. And, you know, even if you hear the story and say, oh my God, like, Ambika, it's fine. No big deal. Like, you're only human, blah, blah, blah. I totally agree, you know, like, I do. But when my daughter said that to me, one of the biggest things I thought of is how I've been insecure about how emotional I am for my entire life. it's probably only in the last few years that I have like fully come to terms with it and healed that part of myself and my relationships. But growing up, being emotional was just seen as a weakness. And in many South Asian families who especially immigrated to America and tried to raise a generation here without much exposure to the West, everyone had to be so strong and resilient and be able to kind of robotically go through the motions and move forward in life because life was hard, that there was no space for our emotions. And that's why I felt like shit today with Ajna, my daughter, because she was trying to express herself. Not only did I not hear her, my emotional response was to become cold and emotionless. And it's these sort of things that run through my mind at 7 p.m. on any given night after a long day of work and all of the things in life that have to happen even if you are outside of your home working. And that is why we need to hear from people like Sahej Kohli, who is my guest in episode 4 of season 2 of my favorite thing, Corner Office Breakdowns. She is the founder of what I believe to be the renowned Brown Girl Therapy, one of the first spaces that was ever created for people of South Asian descent, where Sahej talked about mental health. And mind you, this is in a culture where if you went to therapy, it was because something was wrong with you or you were crazy. And I truly, from the bottom of my heart, don't know if I know any people in my parents' generation of South Asian descent who are in therapy or have engaged with therapy. And if I do, I can probably count them on, you know, less than a hand. But it seems as if our generation, we are second generation Americans born in the United States, or people who are first generation who came here very young. We are getting back in touch with what it means to be feeling humans. And I think for a lot of us, just based on the pure fact that we held so many of our emotions in for so much of our lives, are now very, very emotional people. All of us. I'm not just talking about, you know, the ladies like me and Sahej. I am saying overarchingly, my South Asian friends and my South Asian community, who I love and adore and make up some of the most important people in my life, hands down, are all deeply, deeply feeling and deeply affected people. And I'm speaking from a South Asian experience, but I know that this exists in many, many, many cultures. And so Sahej's book, But What Will People Say, which even the title is iconic, dives into how she first started having conversations about mental health with her own family, which I think sounds very similar to mine and was a quite typical experience for many of us. And the subtitle of the book is Navigating Mental Health, Identity, Love, and Family Between Cultures. This is a preliminary conversation with her because genuinely I got 60 pages into this book and said to myself, if I read any more, I will genuinely not know what to talk to her about, because in the 60 pages, there were probably 30 things I wanted to talk to her about. And y'all know I'm not an easy sell. I read a lot. I research. Strategy is my career. And so it really, really blew me away. And I hope that says something to you all who have been here for a while listening to this podcast. But it is the tip of the iceberg, and Sahej has such meaningful, powerful, empowering content out there that has existed on the internet and now exists in a beautiful, stunningly colored, orangey marigold hardcover book. And another fun thing is we are giving away some of those books. So I will post details of the giveaway on my personal Instagram at @AmbikaGPie and also on the Corner Office Breakdowns Instagram. So if you want to get a book, you know where to find us. And here we go. Here is Sahej Kohli, author and founder of Brown Girl Therapy. Hi, Sahej.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here.
I am so excited to have you. I'm brimming over with just gratitude that you're here as somebody who has helped shepherd so many others, so many immigrants, so many people from, you know, historically under-resourced communities really understand the importance of taking care of their mental health. Brown Girl Therapy is iconic in our community. It has been a resource for so many of us. And when I say us, I mean like the South Asian diaspora, but you know, your thinking really does extend beyond just South Asians. And a lot of the conversations you've been having on, as I called it, your press circuit, as you're gearing up to release your book, have been people from not just South Asian communities really remarking on the relatability and the universality of your book. Mm-hmm. So you are striking some deep, deep chords. But before we get into all of that, I would love for you to just share a little bit about your background, Brown Girl Therapy, how you got there, and then what led you to write this truly magnificent book, which I will make you feel uncomfortable about this whole podcast so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, my story is a little bit, there isn't a clear trajectory. It wasn't a linear process in getting to where I am today, which I think is very common, but we don't talk about enough. So, you know, I am the first in my family to be born in the West. I'm a daughter of Indian immigrants, but I'm also the first in my family to deal with my mental health struggles very openly, to go to therapy. I'm the first in my family to marry outside of race, religion, culture. So my whole life has kind of been, you know, the straddling between the Indian values and norms and expectations at home. And then, of course, with the diametrically opposing Western American values and norms that I was socialized in, which is kind of the, like, you know, traditional child of immigrant, yeah, bicultural straddling that happens. And, you know, I never really had language for it, but I always kind of felt this tension between who I was supposed to be in different environments. And it's something that kind of permeated every part of my life without me even realizing, up until maybe, you know, my college years, when it became more into my consciousness that I was kind of straddling these cultures, that I was navigating different sets of values and expectations. And then in my early 20s, I did experience something very traumatic. And that experience led to a lot of painful and really difficult conversations with my family, my parents specifically, who didn't understand why I was hurting so much, didn't understand why they couldn't help me, didn't understand why I really wanted to see a therapist. You know, I think for them as immigrant parents, they really thought they failed me in some way, which they didn't, but they couldn't get past that thinking. And so, you know, that was kind of the start of a very obvious mental health journey for me, where I didn't actually get the support I needed until many years later when I had that physical distance, emotional distance, and achieved a level of financial independence where I could seek out that therapy and mental health care for myself. And so during those years, you know, I'm fast forwarding a little bit. When I did seek therapy, I was also working in media. And so the experience of being in therapy and being able to like interrogate my stories and do this really hard work with my therapist over the course of 4 years while I was working in media and was editing, you know, personal essays that focused on identity or mental health, it kind of came to a head for me where I realized I wanted to be a therapist. And when I decided to go back to school to be a therapist, I had gotten to graduate school. It was the year I turned 30, the year I married a white American man, the year I decided to change my career. And I was just going through my own personal and professional identity crises. And I just kept being like, there's no way I'm the only one experiencing these things. And so that was kind of the birth of Brown Girl Therapy for me. And Brown Girl Therapy just kind of grew as I was in grad school and getting a very Eurocentric type of training. And, you know, I kept relying on this content and storytelling and this community to kind of fill the gap and bridge the gap between Western psychology and, you know, infusing culture in the ways that we need as immigrants and children of immigrants in these mainstream wellness conversations. And, you know, fast forward to today, you know, my book is coming out and I've been working on it for 3 years. It's the accumulation of all the work I've done on Brown Girl Therapy, my training, my experiences, you know, all the workshops I've done, all the people I've talked to, and here we are.
We are. I mean, and I said this to you in our kind of pre-chat. I didn't realize how much of my own mental health, I guess struggles, if you will, came from my cultural upbringing and how much of it came from the state of being a woman in America. And there were certain topics that you touched on in your book called But What Will People Say that like literally knocked the breath out of me. And it started just where your book started. Like you're driving on a road trip with your father. And immediately I was like, oh, her and her dad are alone on a road trip. And not everyone understands
Yeah, that's a very
the
common reaction in our community, especially daughters, especially daughters.
and I can just imagine, the intensity of that, especially with the underpinning of knowing now your dad's struggling with his mental health, which I think is, I mean, exceptionally common, is we sort of missed an entire generation when it came to taking care of mental health and really kind of diving deep into discomfort and vulnerability and all of these things I feel we are doing now, that one, they never had the opportunity to do, perhaps. They never had the knowledge to seek out. There was never the space to even consider what their options could be to kind of, release some of these feelings. But I felt it when you were talking about your father. I felt it when you were talking about your own psychological distress, how you were one person at home and then a completely different person with your friends at school. This is so embarrassing to say, but like I was the girl that once in a while, I was so conservative, but then I would take a mini skirt to school and be like, I also need to fit in.
Yeah, it's very common. It's
Yeah.
very common. Yeah.
It's so crazy. Like my parents didn't really want me to go to prom or homecoming. I had a white boyfriend in high school, and it was like the talk of the town in the most negative way you can imagine. And growing up in that sort of like stuck in this assimilation paradox of like, who am I at home? Who am I in my like Western community? And then just like, who am I? Period. Full stop. When I'm my most authentic self. I mean, the way you brought that to life right away, I don't know. It really, really deeply, deeply resonated with me. So, first of all, thank you
Thank you for saying that.
so much for the work you are doing.
You've only read the first 60 pages, and I can't believe you're already saying all of this.
Okay, I know.
Get through the
I've
book
only read
first,
the
and then
first
tell me what you
pages.
think. Yeah.
And Sahej says in the beginning of her book that she her publication team or agent or publisher was like, you can't put all of this in one book. And I was like, I frankly can't put even this one book into one conversation. So we are needing
No.
to focus on
Yeah.
chapters 1 through 3 or something like that. But I think one of the most staggering stats that you have right up front in your book is that second generation immigrants, which we are, our parents were born in India and we were the first in our families to be born in the States. So some people say first generation, but it is second generation. Is that second generation immigrants in the US actually have a twofold greater prevalence of psychological distress than their immigrant parents? And, you know, we hear these stories of how our parents came to America and they had, you know, $200 in their bank account and didn't speak any English and, you know, so forth and so on. And then to have that striking of a number where you're like, wait, my psychological distress is potentially higher than somebody who experienced that. That in and of itself was so validating. Can you talk us a little bit through how you got to kind of that understanding of how our situations as, you know, South Asians or just minorities in America today is a little bit more fraught than even those who came before us?
Yeah, you know, it is surprising to a lot of people when they hear that stat, and I think the thing is that when you are a child of immigrants, when you've been born in a new country that is unlike the one that your parents are from, you are from very early life already straddling these different cultural expectations. And so, what we know about the development of our brain is at a very young age, right? We are learning these things about ourselves. We are learning to create a sense of self. We are, when you're 12 years old up until like 19, you are learning to what should be individuate from your family, right? Lean into your unique interests, prioritize your friends, figure out what makes you happy. But when you are a child of immigrants or you come from a collectivist background, you kind of, those developmental processes are delayed in a lot of ways for so many of us because we aren't given that space or encouraged to pursue those things that will make us happy or figure out things, that we as individuals uniquely are interested in or want, because the priority is the family, is what our parents want from us. And for better or worse, our parents, a lot of people come to this country as immigrants without any social support. There are a lot of children of immigrants, especially in the Asian communities, that live in multi-generational households and do have access to grandparents and elders here in the States or in the West too. But like me, I didn't. It was only my parents, my older siblings, and me, and that was it. And so I think that led my parents, if I had to theorize it or hypothesize it, I think that led my parents to kind of sink their nails in a little deeper in us, right? They wanted a little bit more control because there was a lot more to lose for them. There was a lot more fear happening for them, a fear of cultural erasure, a fear that they don't have control, a fear of regret, a fear that they made a mistake, a fear of all of these things. And it built a lot of compassion for me when I think about how my parents raised me. And it had an impact on me because, again, those processes, those natural developmental processes, are delayed for a lot of us. And I want to be mindful that some of these processes just look different for us altogether because when we infuse culture, what is normal in one culture is not the same as the other. And that's okay too. But there is a level of straddling that happens between these cultural streams that makes it a little bit harder for those of us who are born in a new country to kind of figure out who we are, what makes us who we are. And that impacts our mental health. And I really do think that is why our mental health is a little bit worse off than our immigrant parents.
And it's so interesting. So 12 to 19 is when, you know, adolescents or young adults experience this individuation process. But it's also very likely when this idea of impression management starts to come into play. Can you talk a little bit about impression management, and what that means?
So it's 12 to 19 or 12 to 21. Don't quote me on that, but it is like the, it's those years where we are all kind of figuring out who we are, but it's also when we might have those pressures at home of like figure out where you're going to college, figure out what you're going to do next, figure out how you're going to like, do all these things that's expected of you as our child. But yes, and to your point, impression management does play a big role in it because when we think about those age ranges, right around 13, we start to develop and become really egocentric. And that's just really natural because if you think about any preteen or young teenager, right, the whole world revolves around them. Like when you are a young person, the whole world revolved around you. You were worried that people would notice that pimple on your face. You thought people were talking about you behind your back. When you brought in lunch from home and it smelled, it made you feel a little bit more shame than maybe it should have. We want to fit in. You want to be accepted. You want to belong. It's a very natural human thing, but especially as a young person where you're like, your brain is like developing and you're learning your role in all of these environments you are a part of. And things just feel so much bigger and heavier and more weighty. The experiences just feel more weighty for us. And so impression management plays a role in that because impression management is this idea that we manage the ways other people perceive us. And it's not necessarily bad, right? You think about going to a job interview, you want to manage the impression you're giving of the person who's going to hire you. You want to come off as capable. You want to come off as skillful. And so we all kind of engage in impression management in some way. It's not necessarily a bad thing. But research suggests that people from collectivist backgrounds actually engage in impression management more. And that's because we worry about what other people will think, right? I mean, my book is called But What Will People Say for a Reason? And so when we think about that, we start to develop false sense of self. We start to perform a little bit. We start to use flattery. We start to try to associate ourselves with people who will make us look good. We try to do all of these things that will manage. We try to be likable. We try to be easy to be around. We try to keep the peace. We try to do all of these things that will manage the way that people perceive us and that will help us feel more belonging and acceptance and validation in these relationships or in these environments. And so, I think that that's a really interesting thing we don't talk enough about. And it's when I came across that research, I knew I had to put it in the book because it's not something I've really heard people talk about. This concept of us really caring and where that actually comes from and why we do it. It's a survival mechanism in a lot of ways.
And one of the topics I've previously talked about on the podcast, and I just think a lot about, is kind of the power and the poison of external validation. And I think, I grew up thinking external validation was the most important thing in the world, right? I wasn't smart. I wasn't good at what I did. I wasn't pretty. I wasn't nice. I wasn't anything unless somebody reflected that back to me. And I still struggle with that to this day. I was just talking to my therapist about it. I was like, I'm really excited about my podcast right now because I'm getting some guests that I'm just amazed. I'm having that kind of like, this is my life moment. But then I'm like, but that's just internal. Like, I don't feel like I'm getting any external validation. And then she's like, well, why does that matter? And I'm like, good question. Why does it
Well,
matter? And
even more than why does that matter is why, what is it that you are looking for other from looking for from other people that you're not getting?
there were so many words that were used to describe me when I was little, right? Like weird. I remember once being called defective merchandise because I was like tall and awkward. And also, you're an Indian girl in a predominantly white community. That's where I grew up, at least. And I had a name people couldn't pronounce. I had beliefs people didn't understand. I had, didn't eat beef at the time. I had that. And so I was just weird to them. And then at home, very similar to what you talk about in your book, I sort of would retreat to my own room and like my own little world. And then that was weird too. And so this impression management thing, I think is so far reaching because you're right. We do it every day, in our careers, in our relationships. And I feel like our parents really had to do that too.
Yeah, it's a
So,
survival mechanism.
yeah, and like, they were trying to show that they were connected to their home country and their culture and living the values that their parents instilled in them, while being in America with, an American teenager, for all extents and purposes. And I think it was all impression management and keeping up with the Joneses and trying to just, blend in as much as humanly possible across every aspect of life.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think it was blending in, but it was also standing out in some ways where they, there's a lot of like, I write about this in my book, but especially in the South Asian community, just because I am Indian and I can speak to that more closely here, this whole idea of like comparing kids to their peers or, parents just kind of getting together to talk about their kids and brag about their kids. And when things feel bragworthy, then they can feel okay that they're, it's all a little bit superficial versus it being like, are my kids happy? Are they healthy? Are they getting different needs met? Which is, again, I know something we might talk about and something that I bring up in the book, but our parents only see that level of success and happiness as one definition, one metric that they're looking for, which is like academic, career, partner choice, all of these things versus, trying and failing, or making a mistake and growing from it, or learning your self-worth, or all of these other things that are just as important, but we don't talk about or make room for.
And so there is that duality between, blending in and then the exceptionalism, which you talk about in your book. It's like exceptionalism is the other side of the coin, right? So that's what you're kind of referring to is on one hand, we are kind of shrinking away or trying to blend in as much as humanly possible. But then on the flip side, we are expected to be exceptional. Get the best grades, go to the best Ivy League schools, get the best jobs, choose one of four paths, which insanely enough is still a thing to this day,
Yeah.
I feel. And so I think that that duality is the crux to me of a lot of where all of this stems from.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, based off of like I think it relates to what I had said before, which is this idea that like our parents are so fearful that they might have made a mistake moving here if it was by choice, right? Not every, there's refugees, there's people who come here who flee and don't come by choice. But I think those who do, like my parents, I do think looking back, and I don't have any research to back this up, just it's just me hypothesizing what I've seen in the community. It's almost like they want to overcompensate for the fact that they moved. So therefore they put that kind of pressure on us, their kids, to overcompensate and say, look, see, this is the land of opportunity. And now they're doing X, Y, and they're doing X, Y, and Z, which they might not have been able to do if I stayed back home. And that puts a lot of pressure on us kids because, one of the biggest narratives I'm seeing recently, right? If you saw One Day, or, is this idea that why can't we as brown people just be normal people who live normal lives and do normal things, like play a role that's not necessarily made for a brown person, but she can play it and just do it. Why do we have to be? And I know it's ironic I'm saying this because I wrote a whole book about this, but why do we have to write and talk about our identity and our trauma and our histories in order to feel relevant or important? And I just feel like that pressure for me, and I think for a lot of other people, comes from this idea that we're trying to compensate for something else or compensate for our parents' fears. And I just think that becomes internalized for so many of us.
Can I bring up something weirdly controversial that we did not discuss prior to this?
Yes, please.
Which is, I don't know if you felt this growing up. I'm assuming you did. But I had the hardest time with other Indian girls and women. And to this day, speaking of performing, there is no one I am more nervous to talk to or be in front of than another Indian woman. And there's something, I mean, devastating about that, first of all. It's like a deeply sad thing. And I do think things are getting better and we're kind of moving past that as a collective. But the fact that that even existed is so interesting to me. And does that play into the exceptionalism slash, we are just getting to this point as women in general where we're saying things like, there if this table isn't big enough, create more room at the table, get a bigger table, don't exclude other women. And this idea of resources or, success or fame or money or acknowledgement being scarce. And so I wonder if that has come into your world and your thinking at all as you've been writing and, diving deep into this topic for the last several years.
For sure. I think it's a form of internalized white supremacy. I think that we live in a country where, as marginalized people, right, of any color and background, if you're marginalized, you're not of the dominant white society, heteronormative society, then we are made to feel like we don't belong. And so there's a difference between us having imposter syndrome because we feel like we're not good enough and being told we're not good enough because we're in systems that are failing us constantly. And I think it's a level of internalized white supremacy for us to feel like we're in competition with one another, that this is a zero-sum game, that if you make it, I won't make it because there's not enough room for all of us to make it. And I think that I have definitely seen that within the South Asian community. And, I know we're not alone because I've had these conversations. And it can be as micro as maybe like just being around other Indian girls and feeling like they aren't trustworthy or I don't feel safe around them. I've had personal experiences starting Brown Girl Therapy where the only people who tried to take me down were South Asian women and specifically Indian women. And it's really hard for me to wrap my head around that because these are the people I wanted to be in community with and wanted to help and wanted to collaborate with and wanted to support. And it can be as macro as just all of us feeling like we're not going to be good enough in a system that isn't designed for us. So I think it can happen on different layers, and it's really, really unfortunate. It's really unfortunate,
It
and it's
is.
really sad, and it's really heartbreaking. And it just leads to more disconnection. And I think in some ways it's ironic because we come from communities and cultures where we really do prioritize being there for one another and community care. And yet within those communities, within those insular communities, we are still saving face or putting up walls or being in competition with one another, which only leaves us fractured and disconnected on the inside, but we don't want to show that to the outside world because we want to seem like we're cohesive and all together. And it's just this ugly cycle. It's this ugly cycle.
It is. And I the reason I almost struggle to bring it up is because I so badly want that not to be a thing.
I know. Me too.
At no point was I like, I want to have Sahej on because she's Indian too, and blah, blah, blah. I was like, I want to have her on because the things she is sharing are, I'm going to toot your horn for you, but like they're profound. You're going into like really wounded people and a really wounded culture and a really wounded kind of group. And helping heal a lot of trauma through this book. And so I have so much respect and admiration, and I am feel blessed to be in this like Indian sisterhood with you.
Thank you. I really, really, really appreciate that. I mean, that is so kind. And I'm so happy to be here. I mean, a part of doing this work is to combat that competitiveness and to, say yes to opportunities where I know that it can be mutually reciprocal and we can help each other. And that's the whole point of community and these
Absolutely.
types of conversations.
You talk about in your book when culture becomes a scapegoat for toxic behavior. And that feels to me related to this conversation about exceptionalism and, if there's room for me, there isn't room for you. And I mean, culture becoming a scapegoat for toxic behavior is, I mean, that to me is like a headline because I think that is just the world we are living in so many ways. For instance, we live in a culture of pr productivity, and so when the world is falling apart on the other side of the world, we can't fall apart with it because We need to be resilient and we need to get shit done and we need to be present in our lives and we can't show too much emotion. And so I want to just linger on that for a minute because I think that exists absolutely in the Indian community and the South Asian community and, a lot of historically marginalized communities overall who did have to kind of straddle these two worlds and make decisions based on what felt safe and logical versus always what was right. But how do you think Indian culture or South Asian culture did become a catch-all for some of the more negative behaviors we've seen and grown up with?
That's a good question, and I think there's a lot of different factors at play, right? For instance, at the root of it, most of us, our parents did the best they can. Does that mean that they were healthy? Does that mean that there was a goodness of fit where they like really tended to our needs and paid attention? Probably and maybe not, but they did the best they could. And a lot of doing the best they could also included and was embedded in the ways that they were parented, the time and generation they grew up in their immigration stories, in their acculturation stories, in all of these things, in their own access to community and social support and care and survival and finances and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And so I think things get passed down, right? A lot of this is rooted in intergenerational patterns and behaviors and conditioning. And at the root of it is there's a lot of fear of changing the norm. And what is normal for one person is not normal for another person. What is normal in one culture is not normal for in another culture. What is healthy, what feels okay and is tolerable to one person, even in a family, might feel intolerable or not okay at all to another family member in that same family system, right? So what like even in that the chapter you're talking about in the beginning of my book, what I'm trying to do here is to just address and challenge everyone to interrogate what is normal to them. How have we come to just believe that, our parents taking their sandal and like throwing it at us is just a normal thing that Indian parents do, right? Like, that's a very specific but also common example in our community. Or that, being angry is okay for men in the family and not women or whatever it is, right? Like when we think about these normalized, and I'm using quotes here, normalized behaviors, they come from somewhere and they serve someone and they don't serve other people. And it's our job to kind of interrogate where that comes from. And I've had many conversations with my parents, my mom specifically, where I'll be like, oh, why is something the way it is, right? Because my parents loved the whole, this is just the way it is, just because I said so. And I was always that kid who was really annoying, who challenged back, but why, but why, but why, but why, but why? And even as an adult, but why, mom? And she's like, because that's just how it's always been done, because that's how my parents did it. And I turned out fine because, that's just how it is. Oh, you're too American if you think otherwise. You're too American if you do this. You're too American if you do that. And so for me, it really kind of reflecting on these experiences caused me to be like, caused a lot of these feelings to come up that I put into that first chapter of the book where I'm like, okay, but just because it's been done that way doesn't mean it's okay. Just because it's normalized and we've all learned to accept it doesn't mean it's healthy. And that, I think that is where we need to start asking questions and getting clarity on where does this stuff come from and why? Why is it normalized? And that goes for like even macro society, dominant society, patriarchy, right? When we think about white supremacist values, what is when we think about professionalism in a Western world, you're supposed to look a certain way, your hair is supposed to look a certain way, you're supposed to dress a certain way, but why? Why? Who got to dictate that? Where does that come from? Who does it serve? Who is it excluding? And I think that's the point of that kind of conversation for me is like really digging and pulling on the thread a little bit and asking more questions as to like why.
And one of the most amazing things you do is you actually do give people guidance on how to have those conversations. And it seems like it comes from your own experience, right? Like we started earlier talking about how your book begins with a road trip with your father, and how for some of us, immediately we're like, oh shit, what's gonna happen on this road trip with our dad? Because they probably haven't talked about too much in their lifetimes. And so the tools that you are providing and some of the tips you're giving on how to have these conversations with a generation of people who, my grandmother, bless her, still says to me when I remember when I was experiencing really bad postpartum depression, she said to me, "Depression is for white people." She was like, "This is not a thing. Depression is for white people. It's for people who have had a really rosy life, and you're not depressed." And I think that's reflective of a lot of the conversations that we have with people from, previous generations as a culture. And so the tips you give are really interesting and really valuable, where you're reflecting back, this is what you said, this is how I interpret it. But what if we thought about it a different way? Can you give us some of those tips here and now, that you talk about in your book?
I'm just having some difficult conversations.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest things is like for anyone having a difficult conversation, oftentimes what's happening is that it feels really high stakes, or you feel like you're having opposing views with someone. You feel like, you don't know what the intention is behind the conversation. So there's already things that are setting you up to feel defensive or to feel like I need to be heard. And as a couples therapist, I see this all the time in my work with my clients. And what's usually happening is that there's a parallel process. If you don't feel heard, it's likely the other person also doesn't feel heard. And so in order to bridge that gap, we want to validate each other's feelings. We want validating does not mean agreeing. Saying, I'm seeing that you are really concerned about this, or I can understand that you're frustrated, does not mean that I agree as to why you're frustrated. It doesn't mean I agree. But it means I'm validating and I'm receiving your feelings and I'm making space for them, which allows you to feel heard. And it will also hopefully give you space to validate and receive my feelings and make room for both of them. We all have our truths, right? Our truths are never going to be exactly the same. And so in having these difficult conversations with people who you may feel like are constantly misunderstanding you, really validate where they're coming from. What is rooted behind what they're saying? What is the emotional intention behind what they're saying? What is the foundational fear in how they're bringing this up or why this is important to them? And really addressing those things. And I think reflecting is another tool, a conversation and a communication tip that I just think is really valuable. So instead of jumping to, explain yourself or to answer the question, you might just reflect what you heard. Oh, so I'm hearing that this bothered you because I did this. Am I hearing that right? And just getting explicit, definition and clarity on what the person means. If my mom was to tell me, oh, you never help me around the house and I just did the dishes, I might be really frustrated and say, what is she talking about? I literally just left the kitchen and did the dishes. But instead of getting upset and being like, I just did the dishes, why are you like always nagging me? I might say, well, what does it look like for you to know that I'm helping you? And she might say, well, I've had to take your sheets off of your bed for the last 5 months. And that might be a very specific behavior that she needs me to do to feel like I'm helping around the house. And so really getting clarity on what people mean when they use words like trust or help or whatever it is, right? Whatever the conversation is about. I think that curiosity goes a long way into showing the other person that you really want to understand so you can help find solutions together rather than feeling like you're both just talking at each other and in circles because you both want to be heard.
And I think that is such a good point, and I'm applying it both now in my brain to my relationship with my parents and my husband, because we have two little kids, we both have intense jobs, we travel for work, we have our things on the side like this podcast, and it always comes out of our mouths in a very overarching way, right? It's like, you never help me around the house, or I do everything for the kids, or I take care of all of our finances, or whatever the argument is. But actually, once you start to kind of interrogate that in a kind, empathetic way,
Yes.
you realize that it is usually very small, like almost turnkey things that can be done to just make you feel like you are being seen and heard. And I think because we have been so trained or conditioned to not talk about our feelings and to just internalize, when it comes out, it does come out explosive and overarching because there are 30 things that have happened to get you to that point. So I mean, personally, so much, I've had to do so much unlearning and recalibrating what communication even means to me, and recalibrating, you know, I was criticized so much for being sensitive growing up, which I know
Same.
a lot of us were, right? So I turned into somebody who just like took every piece of shit from every single person and then exploded once in a while. And we all know that's not sustainable, but it took so much energy to say, okay, every time something small happens, I want to acknowledge it, even if the other person feels like I'm being crazy or weird or overly sensitive or whatever, because it also matters how I'm feeling navigating my life and relationship, not just how they feel.
I mean, I agree. And I think that's what happens a lot is we'll have people say, well, this has been going on for a really long time. And I'm like, well, why haven't we tried to talk about this? And most of the time it's because there's people don't know how to talk about this or how to have these conversations. I think there's, you know, the other side of that coin too, which is sometimes there comes a point in relationships, especially for those of us who want to maintain our relationships with our elders and our family members who may not change, may not be willing to do any of the work, may not be receptive to any of these, you know, questions or ways that we want to do things, or have conversations. And I think to that point, I would say sometimes we just have to decide it's not worth responding or bringing it up again, right? Sometimes if we've tried enough and nothing's happening, for instance, the other, you know, weekend I went home and I found myself getting really frustrated and activated around my parents. I love my parents. I have a great relationship with them now. But still, when I go home, I revert into a child and I immediately start to feel like, you know, I get defensive. I want to stand up for myself. And I had to have a moment with myself where I walked away, went to my room, counted to 10 and said, is this even worth it? Like, what is, like, do I want to just go downstairs and continue the day where we're like playing cards and having a good time? Or do I want to try to have a conversation that I know I've had and isn't going to go anywhere? And at the end of the day, we have to make that decision. When are we willing to try to have these conversations? And when are people showing us who they are? And when do we have to accept that?
And when is it okay to make a decision based on how you feel and what you need versus what the other person needs? Because that also, you know, is part of why I think we've kept ourselves silent for so long, is because we don't want to offend our parents, hurt our parents, you know, disrespect them. But you say, you know, we know our parents love us. Like, what a privilege, right? To be loved by your parents. And I will never doubt that for a second in my life. But how they chose to love me and how the love was exerted on me didn't feel very loving.
And it's very different from maybe loving you emotionally, or, you know, I think what happens a lot of times is so many of us might have had some needs met, whether it was like physical, physiological, we had food on the table, we didn't have to worry about money. You know, we were going to school, we were well fed, we were bathed, we were clothed, all of these things. But then, you know, I don't have any memories of my parents, you know, putting me to bed or kissing me goodnight or telling me they love me until I got older. And I just feel like that affects a child. And I know I'm not alone. And I think it's really hard. I work with clients who say, it's fine though. You know, it's fine. They did the best they could. And I'm like, is it fine? Because now we are adults who struggle with that emotional connection, struggle to have our needs met, don't believe our needs are worthy. And that can have, you know, real repercussions on our relationships as adults. And so it's okay to acknowledge that both things can be true, that our parents did the best they could, and some of our needs were met, and some of our needs were not met.
Absolutely. And you know, as I navigate parenting now, parenting my two little Indian children, it is something I reflect back on a lot. So I was telling Sahaj at the beginning of our conversation, like, I'm not only seeing this as, you know, retreating back into my childhood self and feeling it from her point of view, but also feeling it as a mother. And so it's really helping me be aware of how I want to raise my children and what I want to instill in my children from the Indian culture and from, you know, who we are today and what we've learned today. I have one parting question for you.
Yes, please.
My favorite feeling in the world, which I've already done with your book, is when you like hold a book to your heart and you're just like, holy shit, like that struck a chord. What part of your own book made you do that? Like, what was the thing in your book that you were like, this unlocked something for me?
Oh, that's a really good question. My favorite chapter is chapter 5.
Okay.
And I think that's because chapters 1 through 4 are kind of in the memoir part of it, are
Yes.
more of my younger life.
Yeah.
Chapter 5 is more of like I'm in my 20s, I'm figuring things out for myself. And it's really a turning point in the book where chapter 5 and chapter 6, things kind of just take a turn for me. And I think that chapter and that reading the book as the narrator when I did the audiobook a couple weeks ago was the first time I actually read my book from start to finish in a really long time, in several months. And doing that just gave me chills when I got to like that midway point, chapter 5, chapter 6, and realized that, our stories can change directions at any time. And I think in writing my story and in wanting to write my story before I even got it all on paper, I had one very specific narrative that I subscribed to, which was really full of shame. I talk about failing in college. I talk about my assault. I talk about all of these things that felt like quote unquote failures and negative things that happened to me that were a moral failing on my part. I know they're not, but like they felt like they were. And they were things I never wanted to kind of unbox ever again. But in writing this book, I was able to unbox them and heal from them. And I tell people all the time, of course I want everyone to read my book, but if no one did, the process of even writing this book has been so liberating and so healing in so many ways that I think I got what I needed out of it and it's no longer mine. People can take what they need to from it and I hope it reaches the right people, but it's not mine anymore.
That's beautiful. I want to leave the listeners, our listeners, with one quote that I wrote, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, fucking bullseye next to
Oh, I'm excited to hear.
And that is, I knew neither how to struggle nor that struggling wasn't a core failure. And that to me, when I mean, you can tell by my annotations, I do think a lot of us were taught to believe that failures meant that we failed. And I think what it's so important to reconcile is that a lot of times failure is contextual. A lot of times we may not have failed, we may have been failed. People have failed us, culture has failed us. You know, sometimes our parents have failed us, or we have failed each other. And so I think just getting comfortable with the idea that struggling in and of itself and hardship in and of itself isn't a reflection of something negative about you is beautiful and so
Yeah.
important.
Thank you. I'm
Thank
really excited for you to read the rest of the book and tell me
you.
what you
I
think.
know I'm gonna have to bother
Take
you
your time.
like
Yeah, take
part
your
two, part three, part four. Like,
time.
I haven't even gotten to the 20s. You know, that's going to be a whole thing.
Yeah.
But this was such a pleasure. Please, everyone, buy this book. I cannot speak highly enough of the 63 pages I have read. And I will be sharing all of the juicy bits that I encounter as I read. But Sahej, this is just, I'm so happy for you. I'm so in awe of you and your work. And I so appreciate you being here with us. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me and for this really great conversation. It was great.
It was great. All right.
Yeah.
Until next time.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.